This morning, I actually forgot to mention it. It's, you know, off the side of the side road, kind of, if you will. But I had a slide, and I'll show it to you in just a second, that is of this structure, which was built by, you know, Islamic peoples in 1229 AD. So it's not biblically related at all. But I always like to have my little geography lesson, you know, as you know. And what this is all of northern Galilee and the beginnings of the Jordan River, which is created. It has three sources, but one of the major sources is a spring that gushes straight out of these rocks 1 mile away, just on the other side of this hill. Now, it's a very steep mile, as you can see. Just a mile away is what they call Benias. We call Caesarea Philippi. But this location not only oversees all of Galilee, in northern part of there, the valley in the Jordan River, but it's also only about 30 miles away from Damascus. So when you think of the ancient travels, Abraham, as he comes up the Fertile Crescent, you know, in the very beginning, in Genesis 12, he's asked to leave and come to this promised land himself. He was probably marching right through here and coming down into that valley and headed down. It's the natural course that you would take as you come along the Fertile Crescent. So you can see a little bit of those ruins right there. It has always been, you know, fortified location for the Jews, for the peoples that preceded them, for all peoples, as they fought their battles and tried to defend their land. This is the picture I showed you this morning. I blew it up, though, so you can see that the entire mountaintop right there is just, as it were, crowned, has been wearing these battlements now for some 800 years. This congregation, I have no doubt, brethren, enjoys the peace that it does. As a result of the work of men like these two, whom you know so well. This photograph was taken in Franklin, Tennessee. As you see, it's labeled in June of 1989. Of course, that's the brothers, Jerry and Don Bassett. I did not know Don except through Jerry, and he preached a meeting for us when we had arrived, Don and I, you know, so I've heard him preach a few times. But these two men, you know, have had a profound influence over this congregation. Jerry for decades, I guess, and then Don through him. There's another photograph in 1993. Sorry about that being cut off. We'll boot that computer again later there. But, you know, it is because these men knew their Bible so well and had managed their lives so well that their influence, I think, will be felt in this congregation for very long time to come. You've been well taught. You've been well served by such individuals as these. This is the last time that those two brothers were together on this earth. That photograph was snapped on May 23rd of 2016. And we would lose Jerry not even a month later. On June 15th, he would leave this earth. And Don, his brother, would follow him that same year, 2016, on September 8th. And so the mighty have fallen. Now we carry on the work after their parting. We have, you know, fond memories, but we also have, you know, almost like, you know, they're in our DNA. They're a part of our lives. It's never going to go away because of the teachings that we all, you know, had heard for such a very long time. Now, Don was a complete stranger to me, except, as I say, the few times that he visited here in the last few years. And so I'd never been to Collierville. I had never seen this museum that's in the red part of, you know, on the end of that building there. Have any of you been there to see the work that Don did in what he had called, as you can see now, is the Biblical Resource Center and Museum? That's in Collierville. Oh my, I think that's Tennessee, isn't it? Was it Tennessee? They lived in Tennessee. Yeah, Tennessee. Okay, Collierville, Tennessee. That's a marvel to me, and I've never even been there. If you can imagine, you know, a single individual having an idea, a man then going to all the tremendous effort that it would be, and then the expense, you know, to say, I'm going to set up on the main square of our town, in what is the downtown location there, you know, right on the square, a Bible museum, you know, and run that for years and years and years. These are photographs that I took off the internet, and just one snapshot of a single room, you know, that's on the inside right there of that museum. It still continues, even though Don is gone. I know they've changed the name now. They're revamping the website and everything is changing, but the influence goes on. And that influence has gone on also in this book right here. We've had a month ago discussions in the elders' business meeting what to do with this time slot after the parable study was over, what we're going to be doing after Nehemiah. Next Wednesday will be our last class in Nehemiah. I finished 2 Thessalonians this morning. You know, what are we going to be doing in the sermons there? And Lenny had suggested that since the teens have just been through this book, that it might be a good idea for us to look at it in this time space as well. The teens, I hope, will be well served to have a little bit more of this information here, but for the adults' sake as well. And so there's the cover of this book, which you can see is called Joseph's Code. It is a study of the life of Joseph. And one of the last things, apparently, that Don did in this life. And still his influence goes on in this congregation. Teens just finished a week or two ago, thanks to Dean Anderson, this study. Now, up here it says, Exploring Ancient Ephesus. This is a photograph of Don in Ephesus some years ago. I just want to read this for you. He's the chairman, or was chairman and co-founder of the Museum of Biblical History in Collierville, there it is, Tennessee. Studying traveled extensively in Bible lands to museums in Europe, the Middle East, and the United States in pursuit of his interest in historical and archaeological backgrounds of the Bible. He studied biblical archaeology in Israel as part of his master's degree program in religious studies from Harding University Graduate School of Religion. His doctorate is in biblical studies from Trinity Theological Seminary, received his undergraduate degrees from Florida College, and a degree with honors in history from the University of South Florida. His 35 years of church ministry included developing religious libraries and curricula in Bible studies and family-oriented study aids, like this one that we're looking at. In addition to academic lectures and presentations, Bassett conducted tours to lands of the Bible, including Israel, Jordan, Turkey, Greece, and Egypt. His wife Nancy, a son and a daughter, and six grandchildren have survived him. And so, you know, this is, to say the least, a man who devoted his life to the study of his God and the Word of his God, which we were spending so much time wanting to defend in our Bible class as we've been studying miracles, you know, and looking at the role that miracles have played. Don is one of the millions, I guess now in 2,000 years, of those that have seen that there is a God, that Jesus is the Son of that living God, that he died for our sins, a real man who went to real places and did real things, and devoted his life then not just to the Bible study itself to understand, you know, what the message is in the verses, but to see the context, to place it, you know, in its context archaeologically and geographically. And so what we're going to do is it'll be, you know, exceptionally different than what the teen class was like, but we're going to simply be studying the life of Joseph here for just a few weeks. It's not going to last for months at all, but for a few weeks we just want to do like Don did and say, let's just contemplate the story of this man. So if I say Joseph, you know, 11th son of Jacob, who had been renamed as Israel, you know, what are the things that come to mind? And just with the man's name, suddenly a lot of images can come to mind. The reason for this is that while he's introduced earlier in the in the book of Genesis, some 12 chapters of Genesis are devoted to this man. It's nearly 25% of the book of Genesis revolves around Joseph. He played such a monumental role in the history of Israel that as you think about all the books of the Bible, I mentioned a little while ago, but if all the books were written about Jesus, they'd fill all the world, you know, there toward the end of the Gospel of John. And when the Holy Spirit is culling out all that might have been said to become the biblical record, and then in Genesis, your book of beginnings, the backdrop, you know, for all things, if that man's going to occupy 12 chapters, then ask yourself if God thought he was kind of important. Well, I guess. And so he's also mentioned several times to two different places in the New Testament as well. So it's not just even an Old Testament character. But by the time he's 17, he's been kidnapped, sold into slavery, and hauled off to a foreign country. 13 years later, he's the prime minister of Egypt. Think about that transformation for just a minute, and what God thought about him, what God was doing with him. Well, in the process, of course, he would rescue all of Israel, including the brothers that had so shamefully mistreated him. He would save the Jews from starvation in the course of that famine. And eventually, though they would have intermediate periods of awful travails, including 400 years of slavery in Egypt, those people would survive and fulfill the redemptive plan of God that culminates in the coming of Jesus as one of the descendants of Abraham through Judah, one of these 12 sons, though not in this case Joseph, but through one of those 12 sons of Jacob, giving us these 12 tribes. These events are singularly important in the long history of God's scheme of redemption, which brought you to these pews here this evening. So we're just going to go and spend some time with this man. Tonight, we're going to be just looking at a few chapters in a big hurry to try and just set the stage. So more kind of on the lessons of his life than maybe we'll be seeing tonight, but we're at least going to try to get our feet under us, you know, as what transpires in the beginning parts of his life at least. So please do come to chapter 37. A moment ago, Ron was reading verses 2 through 4. In the first verse, Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. So, where his father, of course, never had so much as a square foot, Jacob now is going to be well established. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. So let that story of the 12 tribes of Israel then begin. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. So there were several wives, and therefore several sons and daughters. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now, just at the outset, I think it's at least worthy of note that if you're going to reveal then the records of these sons of Jacob, would you think you would start with number 11? Hardly. You'd think the first word might come in there somewhere, and then the second, you know, and the third. So it just gives us an idea of the prominence, the singular importance of this man, that when we're going to start off with the records or the generations of Jacob, Joseph, when he's 17 years of age, is the place that God wants us to start our thinking. He's a teenager, and he will be for a couple more years. And then, oddly enough, what's the first thing you learn about him? He ratted his brothers out. It's like, what? Why would we even need to know such a thing? So, brethren, you do. You have to spend a moment and say, well, now, wait a minute. That wasn't a joke. It's not the punchline when God tells us that. Why did God want us to know that? What am I supposed to gather from this? It's certainly not pointless. It's certainly not empty and useless. If God wants that to be in a record that is edited down from toppling the earth with too many books, then it's got to mean something that I'm supposed to contemplate, that I'm supposed to think about and know. Now, I can think myself, and maybe you can come up with more, and if so, let me know, you know, after the lesson is done, that God stated it there as he wanted us to understand. I'm thinking of two things. Number one, we're going to find out that for a number of reasons, his brothers really don't like him. So, this is the first time that his brothers, you know, are going to have a grudge. It's the development of that. So I can appreciate that historical, you know, notation there. But brethren, you know, I had two brothers. Most of us have brothers and sisters. We've been through, you know, those years. And typically, usually, and hopefully, you know, you love your brothers and sisters. You are common players in a single family. You have similar experiences. These are your first, you know, support group members who will care for you and take care of you. Okay? But right off the bat, we find that this man, Joseph, will bring back a bad report to his parents about his brothers. Now, of course, I understand that when we start thinking about that, children will often squabble and tell on each other, and parents will try to help them with that. Don't come running every time, you know, something happens, you know. But on the other hand, brethren, it is also true that there is, you know, a band of brothers. You look at Jerry and Don, and you think about the book that, you know, Jerry wrote about their early times, and they, you know, these kinds of stories that you've heard about them from other sources and all of that. They were more than friends. They were brothers. And brothers, as often as not, will also not rat each other out, but what? Cover each other when they ought to be ratted out. They become thick as thieves and in league with each other. So this is the only other thing that I can think of as I see God asking us to say, you know, let's spend some time here. Why did God want me to know that? So in that statement, though, at least we can get the supposition, the inkling, you know, the maybe and the perhaps, that already at 17, you see a statement about character. If my brother... Now, bear in mind, they're all older than he is. He's the little one. All my brothers misbehave. What would be the little brother's, you know, temptation, if you will, when you got 10 brothers putting pressure on you not to reveal some misdeed of theirs? How easy would it be to rise up and say at 17, I'm going to go tell my parents that they have misbehaved, even if the 10 of them are going to gang up against me? So these are the only two I come up with. You tell me if there are others. Why did God want us to know this? As the story develops, we're going to see point after point where it's undeniable that this man has a backbone, and this man will do what's right, even if he expects that he's going to pay horrific prices for it. And this man loves what is right. So it appears to me that God is trying to help us to establish this right from the beginning. So in verse 3, Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age. He made him a varicolored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. That's an important statement. By the time this young man is 17 years old, he is being ganged up upon by all 10 of his older brothers. This is a young man who appears to just be honest, and I'll add the word courageous, because he does stand up and has to endure, experience all this opposition. The next time you're thinking, oh, circumstances are bad and I'm having all these problems, and, you know, not necessarily siblings at all, but whatever goes on, vicissitudes of life, you know, ask yourself, well, how is God shaping my character then? What is God making out of me? Don and I watched just a brutal show yesterday. Sat down for dinner. There it was on MeTV. Gomer Pyle. My, how Gomer was being mistreated. Aunt B came to visit. She was so upset. Why did they treat you like this? Make you mop the floors. Pitch right in. She was going to help you clean the barracks. All kinds of trouble ensues in Gomer Pyle, USMC. From what was that, 1965. But what was the whole joke about? You go into the military for discipline, for strength. You go to learn how to behave in the worst kinds of circumstances. War. What is God doing with you in every book of the Bible? Brethren, every book in the Bible prepares us for war. And it's no joke on the tube. It's not fine, not objectionable family fare. Let's get a couple of yucks, you know, out of Gomer Pyle. It is deadly serious, eternal consequences, Satan versus you. Who will win with the eternal consequences of life or death, you know, on the line? This is the life, apparently, of young Joseph, starting at 17, presented before us as one who is going to do the right thing, even if he becomes a total outcast of his own family. Now, in verses 5 through 11, we'll just pick, you know, continue the reading there. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I've had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. Lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brother said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams, note that's plural, and for his words. Now he had still another dream in verse 9. What's he do? Does he learn his lesson from the first dream and their extreme hatred? Well, he had still another dream and he related it to his brothers. He said, "Lo, I've had still another dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." He related it to his father, to his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. What's going on here? Again, brethren, God isn't going to spell it out for us. He's just telling us the story and then very obviously expecting us to put in, you know, the mental legwork and think, why does God want me to know this? And again, as I try then to work it out, you tell me what you think about after, you know, our time together tonight. It looks to me like he's still trying to love and respect his family even though they're so angry at him. He's trying to continue to work with them. He apparently still respects them. Telling them the dream, I think, not so that he goes, "Oh, I'm going to be better than you," but maybe more likely, just, "What does this mean? What helped me?" He's trying to participate with the family. Now, I'm not going to take the time for it tonight, but bear in mind, that is a really important passage when it comes to understanding figures in biblical prophecy. And in fact, I think one of the better keys in understanding at least one or two portions of the book of Revelation, for instance. Daddy hears that the sun, the moon, and the stars are going to bow down to Joseph. And when Daddy hears this, what does Jacob immediately say? "In sun, moon, and stars, I see father, mother, and sons. I don't see celestial orbs, you know, up in outer space. I think you're talking about us." That's right. And when stars fall from the sky, that just might be that people of great prominence and importance are falling. They're being destroyed. And we're not talking about, you know, interstellar catastrophe. We're talking about the representation of people under these figures. So we get into all that, you know, at some other time. But so far, we've only had 11 verses in this man's life. And from square one, is it easy street for this kid? All 10 brothers declare war before he gets out of his teenage years. His mom and his dad are rejecting you know, inspired messages that God is sending to him. Because in point of fact, they would all be bowing down to him in another 13 years when he becomes second in command in all of the country of Egypt, which none of them can possibly anticipate. It's prophecy. Come to verses 12 through 17. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go, an obedient son." But get ready with your pencil here. So he said to him, "Go now, see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock. Bring word back to me." And he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Brethren, it's a valley in, you know, their regions. But we're looking at about 60 miles apart. Now that is an ancient, venerable culture, very different than ours. They had huge flocks. This is a very big family. And they take those flocks then out wherever they can and face the dangers they must to feed them. So they've ranged 60 miles away. I want you, I'm not giving a date on this, but apparently still these teenage years is what it suggests, go take a journey by yourself, look for the brothers that have hated you, you know, viciously, and go look for them out there in the wilderness, see what you can do. So I'd make a note there, it's about 60 miles away. So he goes in 15, man found him, behold, wandering in the field. Man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they're pasturing." Man said, "They moved on from here. I heard him say, let us go to Dothan." So Joseph went after his brothers and found them another 12 miles away. Okay, so now we're up over 70 miles of journeying that's taking place in here. So what do we see? Well, I'll tell you this. That guy, when he makes up his mind to do what his dad asks him to do, is he going to do it? I use the word doggedly obedient. How easy would it have been after a 60-mile journey to say, "Well, I don't see him. I guess I'll go home and tell Dad I can't find him." Instead, what does he do? Finds him, doing this pursuit again. He's a man of character who understands his place as a subservient one in a social structure, and his responsibility is to be a servant. Now, there's an intervening story in chapter 38. It's kind of an ugly one, too. It does not bear on Joseph at all. So you see here, we're going to skip over 38. But let's look at these first five verses now. In chapter 39, the story comes immediately back to Joseph again. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Now, I'm skipping all of that. You know that story. We're just trying to focus on lessons that we can understand. He is an innocent victim. He's not playing any active role in their now hating him enough to sell him into slavery and get hauled off by the Midianites to Egypt. So I'm skipping over all of that. But he had, in verse 1 of chapter 39, been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, captain of the bodyguard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. He made him overseer over his house. All that he owned he put in his charge. Came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. I ask you, how could Potiphar figure that out? I can think of only one way, brethren. Joseph may be a slave. Joseph may not have any rights, no freedom. He is at the bottom of the barrel for taking commands and not giving them. But whatever he does in his slavery, to whom does he give all the credit to his master for the success in any job he's ever given? Where could Potiphar get the idea that Yahweh, God of this enslaved Hebrew, all by himself, this lone Hebrew, abandoned, sold, you know, to Ishmaelite / Midianite traders. This guy keeps telling me why, when he does something, it goes well. He says it's due to Yahweh. Can you imagine whatever job you've ever occupied? Mark Dahl puts out a fire and then reveals the reason that this works so well is because I'm a Christian in the service. Can you imagine? I can't. Today, we're just so far removed from all of that. Now, I would imagine, again, if I were to pursue Mark here, which I won't do anymore publicly, that they already know this stuff. Brethren, we're supposed to be lights to the world. It stands out. So whether Joseph volunteered it from the beginning or Potiphar got curious and so he told him, you know, I don't know. But however it happens, what has got to be in place? Joseph can't live his life without everybody knowing. No matter where I am, far removed from my people, no matter how badly I've been mistreated, betrayed, and sold by my own brethren, I am a servant of God. And when things work out for me, that is because I pray to that God, I obey that God, and I receive blessings from the hand of my God, because I am not going to serve the sun god of my Egyptian captor. I am a Jew, a Hebrew. I am a servant of Yahweh. And here Potiphar gets the point, brethren. That is a man who knew how to serve both God and man in such an exemplary manner that he just shoots up to positions of prominence and success everywhere he goes because everything he does is in the name of his God. As these years are passing, this Joseph has become an astonishingly impressive, very young man, passing on down now, apparently through his 20s. In verses 6 through 23, you know, the story. Left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, Potiphar did. With him he didn't concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Came about after these events. His master's wife looked with desire, and she made her pass at him. In verse 9, no one greater in this house than I, says Joseph. He's withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I see how specific he is? How then could I do this great evil and sin against what? The sun god Ra down in Egypt? No. She's going to find out just exactly where his allegiances are. And so he refuses, she lies, and the next thing, of course, by the time we get down here to verse 19, came about when his master heard the words of his lying, I put in parenthesis, wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, that his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him, put him into the jail, place where the king's prisoners were confined. He's there in the jail, but the Lord was with Joseph, extended kindness to him, gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail. So whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Brother, how I would, and I think you would too, just as eagerly, how I would, that everybody you ever meet is deeply impressed with the God that you serve. How conscientious you are, how successful you are, how high your moral standards are, how wise you are in decision making. So when you're serving your God, brethren, he has promised to be there with us, to reward us in this life and that which is to come. So as you're looking at the life of Joseph from the get-go in these really early years, he is a, and has he ever learned how to be one, a servant, a slave, A man who has zero respect, his own brothers hate him. He may be a prophet, and we would first contemplate murder and then merely sell you into slavery instead. This is a guy who understands what it is to be faithful. That's Joseph. Now by this time, I'm thinking I'm beginning to understand, I guess you are too, why God would spend so much time with him. This is a triumphant young man. This is courage personified. This is devotion and wisdom to God without parallel. This is a man, young as he is, who will pay any price, every price, so that he can be faithful and pure in the sight of his God. Evil? Impossible. I will not sin against my God. So, perhaps a little wonder that a man like Don Bassett, who is, you know, as accomplished and academic and Bible student as you'll ever find, a man who, you know, spent his whole life in faithful service to the establishment of a museum that goes on after his death, you know, in downtown Collierville, Tennessee. I never built a museum anywhere, you know. This man, Don, would think, you know what? We ought to spend some time thinking about Joseph. Because that boy, he knew how to do it right. And in our heart of hearts, I think most of us would admit, we're not doing it so well as that teenage kid did. Now, are we really? Not so well. So, we'll spend some time with Joseph. As we do, brethren, hear the call of God. Hear God saying, I gave you a Bible filled with examples that you are to practice, to emulate. Do these things, and maybe, just maybe, all will prosper that you put your hand to as well. And all your neighbors will know it. And who knows, but one day, there'll be a museum in Eugene. Okay? Well, who knows what else God can possibly do through you. So as I'm so fond of saying in this case, go thou and do likewise. We can help you in your walk with your Lord. If there's anything in particular that we can encourage or strengthen you regarding, recognize that we must inevitably all of us face our God in judgment. As we sing the song, to prepare to meet our God, if I or the elders can be of help to you, let it be known, please, as we stand and sing.